Today is February the 24th, and this is Kathy bringing you news from Decatur, from both Tribune and the Herald and Review. And I actually think I'm going to start out with the Tribune today. The headline is, American Illinois crews are battling the winter storm. Heavy snow blankets portions of eastern and southern Illinois. And Paul has put the mark on that. This is from Collinsville. Ameren, Illinois employees are fully engaged to meet the challenges of a winter storm that continues to dump snow mixed with wind gusts as the company assesses pockets of outages across eastern and southern Illinois. Ron Pate, Senior Vice President of Operations at Technical Services from Ameren, Illinois, said the company has been monitoring the weather system for several days and placed employees and electric utility contractors on alert status at 10 a.m. Tuesday morning. The company activated the Emergency Operations Center, EOC, at 6 o'clock a.m. We are assessing the damage and deploying the personnel and supplies necessary to begin the job of service restoration, Pate said. Our first priority will be to correct potentially life-threatening situations. We will work closely with hospitals, police, and fire departments, and local emergency officials to update lists of critical facilities that are without power. We then implement power restoration plans focused on restoring power for the greatest number of customers in the shortest length of time. Safety is our first and foremost concern when severe weather strikes, says American Illinois President Richard Mark. The most important safety rule is to stay clear of downed power lines and always call Ameren, Illinois if you see downed lines. If any member of your family has a medical condition, plan and make arrangements to have that person's special needs met in the event electricity is not available for an extended period of time during a storm, Mark added. In addition, Ameren, Illinois encourages customers to use the following tips when preparing for severe weather. Stay away from downed power lines. Stay away from brush, shrubs, and fallen trees that may be hiding these lines. If your electric service is interrupted, unplug or protect sensitive computer and electronic equipment with a high-quality surge protector. Make certain your cell phone is fully charged. Also, remember that cordless landline telephones will not function in the event of a power outage. In addition to the safety and outage information available at AmerenIllinois.com, customers and media can receive timely updates on outage restoration by following the Ameren Illinois News feed at twitter.com/AmerenIllinois and facebook.com/AmerenIllinois. The end of article. Next headline, Interim Chief of Police issues statement on hazardous weather conditions. James Goetz, Decatur Interim Chief of Police, issued the following statement this morning. The wind and falling snow is creating low visibility conditions. The roads can be slick in some areas with secondary roads in worse condition at this point. The Decatur Police Department is recommending that you limit your driving during this inclement weather cycle. If you do have to drive, please slow down and allow yourself enough time to brake. Also, we suggest leaving earlier for your destination so you do not have to get in a hurry. Have a proper supply of fuel in your car and warm weather gear in the chance you get stuck in the cold. For emergencies, call 911. And for non-emergencies, call 424-2711. Please stay safe. And now going up to his city beat, Paul Osborne's city beat. Police cracking down. Distracted driving is a key to increase in traffic accidents. A key contributor to the increase in traffic accidents in Decatur is the use of cell phones and other electronic devices while driving, and the Decatur Police Department is cracking down. During a recent week, the public record shows 36 tickets being written for such violations in Decatur. Recently, the Decatur Police Department indicated that officers will be conducting citywide patrols throughout the year. Here's the statement from the department. The goal of these efforts is to reduce the number of accidents which were up in 2015. We believe the use of electronic devices while driving was the key contributor to the increase in accidents. We ask that drivers obey the law in order to help make our travels through the city of Decatur much safer. Hands-free use of cell phones via a Bluetooth device is recommended. There are few common exceptions to the law. Citizens can use their phone to report an emergency situation to emergency personnel. They can pull to the shoulder of the road and use their cell phone. They can also use their cell phone when normal traffic is obstructed and they have their vehicle in park or neutral. Waiting at a stoplight during normal traffic flow is not an exemption to this law. So take heed, those of you who believe you can drive safely and talk on your handheld cell phone. You may think you can, but the Decatur Police Department doesn't agree, and they have the authority to do something about it. I don't know how many times I've almost been hit by vehicles moving up and down town's Franklin Street, and the drivers are talking on their cell phones. They often drive through stoplights on red and don't even know it. I've seen the look on some of their faces, and even though they've run a stoplight and about hit someone, they don't even know it. I'm sure some of those drivers feel they don't have a problem driving and talking and texting. I guess if you don't see stoplights you run or pedestrians that you about run over, you probably think you can do both. Since the police disagree with you, I know who's going to win this debate. You have been warned. Thanks to Grow Decatur's Bruce Nims and Nicole Bateman for meeting with me recently to explain the status of a group that was formed a few years ago to help Decatur grow. I'll have more about Grow Decatur in a future edition, but between the City of Decatur and the Decatur School Board, things have been more than a little newsy the last few weeks. Anywho, thanks to Bruce and Nicole for the invitation to meet and update me on what the group is doing and where it is headed. I enjoyed it. The Decatur Board of Education was scheduled to meet in closed executive session at Tuesday night's board meeting. Since the print edition of the Decatur Tribune goes to press on Tuesday afternoon, this column is being written without knowing what happened at last night's regular meeting. The closed session was one agenda item of the meeting. Whenever it is the city council or the school board going into closed session, there not only has to be a 48-hour advance notice, which there was in this case, but an explanation of what was going to be discussed in the closed session. According to the notice of the meeting, the executive session is to conduct a student discipline hearing and to discuss the appointment, employment, compensation, discipline, performance, or dismissal of specific employees of the public body and discussion of collective negotiating matters between the board and representatives of its employees. I would hope that the discussion would include extending the contract of Superintendent Lisa Taylor. No formal vote could be taken on superintendent's contract during the closed session meeting. As about everyone knows by now, there is or was a 4-3 split not to renew her contract beyond next year. School board members President Sherry Perkins, Alita Graham, B.A. Butts, and T.J. Jackson constitute the majority of the board against extending her contract. Board members who have publicly made comments about the great job that Taylor has done are Brian Hodges, Dan Oakes, and Fred Spanhouse. I don't think I've ever seen this community so outraged by an informal, unofficial decision. Superintendent Taylor is extremely popular and has done a great job. All the letters and Facebook posts on our site are strongly against the feelings of the board majority and for Taylor. I can't see why in the world there would be any difficulty in renewing her contract. Even if the four board members see the light and change their position and formally vote to extend Superintendent Taylor's contract, in my estimation, they may have seriously damaged their credibility on issues impacting the school district. Several people have posed the question to me that, if they are capable of making such a wrong decision regarding Superintendent Taylor, how can we have faith in them on other board decisions? That's too bad for the board members involved, for the school district, and for moving our community forward. And now switching to the Herald and Review. Front page headline, school board agenda crowded out by contract conflict. So this is sort of what happened after Paul Osborne wrote his column, by Valerie Wells. In spite of an agenda dealing with $3.8 million in budget cuts, reorganization of alternative education, and the issuing of $1.3 million in bonds, the Decatur School Board meeting on Tuesday focused largely on the fate of Superintendent Lisa Taylor and her contract. Public participation took well more than an hour, with the majority of speakers asking the board to reconsider the apparent decision to let her contract expire in June of 2017 without renewal. "Your job is to follow the lead of one person, Superintendent Taylor," said Beth Crichton, who compared her role as an accompanist at Millikan University to the board members' positions of support on Taylor's leadership. "In the end, your job is to make her vision a reality." Dwayne McCoskey, once a board candidate himself, said, as a member of the MacArthur High School Booster Club, he hears of other communities' perceptions of Decatur at away games. "The last 2 years, there's been an amazing turnaround," he said. "I hear how responsible and respectful the kids are, and that's born of the pride they have in their schools, which is given to them by Superintendent Taylor." Grow Decatur member Cindy Dedrick-Wolfer said that one of the organization's goals and the school district's is to make the public schools schools of choice, Taylor said. Taylor, she said, had made significant inroads toward that goal, and her job performance is viewed favorably by teachers, parents, students, and the community. Teacher Martha Henderson said she makes mistakes as a teacher, and her students make mistakes. But what she models for students and tells them is that mistakes can be corrected, and it's the right thing to do. "I'm going to play the role of your teacher right now," Henderson said. "I can't make you correct your mistakes, but I can encourage you to go and count the emails, the texts, and the phone calls and ask yourself, am I a person of integrity?" Overseer Tyrone Cooper spoke in support of Board President Sherry Perkins and a board member, T.J. Jackson, both of whom he said he'd known since they were all children. They grew up together on the West Side, and Cooper said he knew both of them to be people of honor. "I have the highest confidence in the integrity of Sherry Perkins and T.J. Jackson," he said. Janelle Norman, president of the local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Color People, flanked on both sides by fellow NAACP members, spoke for 11 minutes, first to decry the teachers who come to the school in yellow T-shirts with hashtag Team Taylor on the backs, which she said creates a hostile environment. "If black students came to the school with Black Lives Matter on their T-shirts," she said, "what would happen to them?" She also criticized Decatur Education Association, Suzanne Krepps, and the three board members who have spoken in support of the superintendent, Fred Spanis, Dan Oakes, and Brian Hodges. She then spoke to Perkins. "Mrs. Perkins," Norman said, "according to any document on school boardsmanship, the president is the only spokesperson for the board. You have a tough job ahead of you, especially when it seems that some of your fellow board members speak on behalf of the board or the superintendent tells the world about your dutiful discussions with her. White privilege has always been a monster. Your integrity is intact. Thank you for your service." At the end of the meeting, Perkins asked School District Attorney Brian Braun to step to the podium and answer the question of whether the board did indeed take a vote in a closed session against extending Taylor's contract. "I will not report what happened in a closed session without the permission of the board," Braun said, "but I saw no wrongdoing." When Jackson asked him to clarify that remark and answer the question more directly, Braun said, "To discuss whether you voted is to discuss what happened in a closed session." This headline, Municipal League Outlines Policy Agenda for the Legislature, by Dan Petrella. An organization representing towns across Illinois is proposing a legislative agenda that it said would keep money flowing to local governments during the state's budget standoff and give municipalities more control over their bottom lines. The Illinois Municipal League, which represents the state's 1,297 cities and villages, is calling its policy agenda Moving Cities Forward. At the top of the list is a measure ensuring that local revenue sources collected by the state, such as motor fuel taxes and proceeds from casino and video gambling, would continue to be distributed to cities regardless of whether the state has enacted a budget. Some of the organization's other proposals, such as changes to laws governing how workers are compensated for on-the-job injuries and requiring local governments to pay prevailing wage rates for public projects, align closely with Governor Bruce Rauner's turnaround agenda. These and other proposals are intended to strengthen the local government's ability to provide critical services to Illinois taxpayers, said Tom Gray, president of the Illinois Municipal League and village president of Chatham, a suburb of Springfield. The well-known fiscal challenges facing the state are likely to have a negative spillover effect on local government. Gray said, "Providing municipalities with additional flexibility over their finances and operations is the right solution to this problem." The Municipal League also is calling for changes to the arbitration process used to settle contract disputes with police and firefighter unions. The group's proposal would open arbitration hearings to the public and require arbitrators to consider a municipality's current financial situation before awarding pay or benefit increases. Another priority is lowering the population required before a municipality is granted home rule authority, which gives local governments more control over taxes and other issues. Currently, the power is given to towns with more than 25,000 residents or those whose voters approve a local referendum. A Municipal League-backed amendment to the Illinois Constitution, sponsored by Representative Mike Smitty, Democrat of Hillsdale, would automatically grant home rule to towns with more than 5,000 residents. Brad Cole, the organization's executive director, said local residents can speak out on issues in front of their local village board or city council and have much more likelihood of seeing success. They can't do that here when they come to the General Assembly, Cole said. And so this allows that more decisions to be made more locally by the people that are elected closest to the residents. Some aspects of the Municipal League's agenda, especially those that align with Rauner's, are likely to run into opposition from labor unions and their Democratic allies in the General Assembly. The Republican governor's insistence that lawmakers enact portions of his pro-business, union-weakening agenda before he'll agree to tax increases to balance the budget, and the Democrats' refusal to do so have created the state's ongoing impasse. Sean Smoot, chief legal counsel for the Police Benevolent and Protective Association of Illinois, said the union is particularly concerned with the Municipal League's proposed changes to the arbitration process. Arbitration hearings are an extension of the collective bargaining process, which takes place in private, and they often result in contract agreements, Smoot said. The whole purpose of the Collective Bargaining Act is to promote labor peace and to promote the parties reaching an agreement of their own accord, he said. The changes also would limit arbitrators to making decisions based on a snapshot of a municipality's finances rather than the complete picture, Smoot said. As for the proposed workers' compensation changes, he said, the state should make sure that insurers are passing on to employers the savings from 2011 reforms before making more changes. And I think I'll go ahead with the obituaries now. The second half reader did not do those, so we'll pick those up right now. This first one is for Robert Anthony Boehm, Jr., B-O-E-H-M. Robert Anthony Boehm, Jr., 64, of Paloma Valley, California, passed away unexpectedly February 17th. Funeral Mass will be Thursday in St. Bart's Catholic Church. A celebration of life will be in July in St. Thomas Catholic Church. Private visitation will be Wednesday in Paloma Valley Mission, Barry Bell and Hall Mortuary in Paloma Valley. They are in charge of the arrangements. Mary Margaret Calvert, 79, of Clinton, passed away at 3:45 a.m. February 22nd at Heritage Health in Bloomington. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, February 26th at the Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, Illinois, with J. Kent Hickerson and Chad Sparks officiating. Burial will follow at the Mausoleum Park Cemetery, Clinton, Illinois. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, February 25th at the Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton. F. Earl Garner, 84, of Blue Mound, Illinois, passed away on Monday, February 22nd at St. Mary's Hospital. A service to celebrate Earl's life will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, February 26th at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home in Blue Mound. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, with a Masonic Rite service following at 7 p.m. Earl will be laid to rest next to his wife Mary in Hall Cemetery with military rites provided by the U.S. Naval Honors Team. Memorial contributions may be directed to the First Christian Church of Blue Mound. C. Pauline Hayes, 93, of Decatur, passed away Monday, February 22nd at Vanderleith Living Center in Mount Pulaski. She was known for her apple pies, cinnamon rolls, homemade waffles, and pizza, and enjoyed attending Mass at St. Thomas Catholic Church in Decatur. Mass of Christian burial to celebrate Pauline's life will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 25th at St. Thomas the Apostle Catholic Church. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the church service. Burial will be in the Boiling Springs Cemetery. Memorials in memory of Pauline may be made to the donor's choice. Christopher E. Hycock, 46, of Des Moines, Iowa, formerly of Decatur, Illinois, passed away February 12th from natural causes. Surviving is his daughter Carrie Lynn Floyd, 23, of New Jersey. Arrangements for his interment are incomplete at this time. Charles Eugene Hodge, 82, of Decatur, passed away Monday, February 22nd at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, February 26th at the Joins Funeral Home, 401 West Gillogie Street in Newman, with Pastor Kathy Murphy officiating. Burial will be in the Pleasant Ridge Cemetery north of Newman. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday prior to the service. Sarah Evelyn Keith, 87, of Decatur, formerly of Louisville, Kentucky, passed away Monday, February 22nd in the Symphony of Decatur, surrounded by her loving family. Honoring Sarah's wishes, cremation services will be provided by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home and Cremation Center in North Oakland Avenue in Decatur. No services are planned at this time. Ronald Dean Leonard, 67, of Decatur, passed away on Friday, February 19th, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. A memorial service to celebrate and honor Dean's life will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, February 26th, at Dawson and Wyckoff North Chapel, with Pastor Jack Greenwood officiating. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until service time. He will be laid to rest at South Macon Township Cemetery. Memorials can be made to the National Kidney Foundation or to the donor's choice. Jeremy Robert Marsland, 36, of Decatur, passed away on Tuesday, February 23rd, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services to celebrate Jeremy's life will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 25th, at the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to the services. Burial will be in Fairlawn Cemetery. Memorials in Jeremy's honor are requested or suggested to the wishes of the family. A. Laverne Minix, 73, of Decatur, passed away at 3:30 p.m. Monday, February 22nd, in Decatur Memorial Hospital in Decatur. A service to celebrate Laverne's life will be at 12 noon Saturday, February 27th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, with Pastor Milt Flesh officiating. The family will receive friends for visitation beginning at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning until the service time at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Mount Zion Township Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the DMH Foundation. Bill J. Perkins, 74, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 2:25 p.m. Sunday, February 21st, in his home. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 27th, at Brentlinger and Earl Funeral Home in Decatur, with visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, February 26th, at the funeral home. Burial will be in the North Fork Cemetery in Decatur. Memorials may be made to DMH Hospice, Mount Zion Christian Church, or the Salvation Army. Elaine Woodland, 59, of Decatur, passed away on Thursday, February 18th, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Services to celebrate Elaine's life will be at 1 p.m. Friday, February 26th, at the Moran and Goble Funeral Home. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the services. Memorials are suggested to the American Diabetes Association. Lorie Pete Woodley, 85, of Decatur, Illinois, went home to be with the Lord on Sunday, February 21st, at 12:05 a.m. in Decatur. She was surrounded by family and friends as she transcended. Her strong will to live, unwavering faith in God, and the love and prayers of family, friends, and many supporters carried her through a long journey in life. Services in remembrance of her life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, February 27th, at the Kingdom Hall Jehovah's Witness on Pershing Road in Decatur, with visitation held at Walker's Funeral Home on Water Street in Decatur on Friday, February 26th, from 6 to 8 p.m. Burial will be at Kings Hill Cemetery, Covington, Tennessee. And that's all the obituaries we have for today. Back to the front page. Relief at the source. Spinal implants disrupt pain signals for many. This is by Teresa Churchill. Ellen Miller could feel the difference as soon as she got home from the hospital 9 years ago and climbed up the 3 steps from her garage to her house. It didn't hurt, she said. Her trial with neurostimulation just hours old. That's how quickly the Decatur woman knew an electric stimulator would be the answer to the agonizing back pain she'd long suffered from 3 bad discs. Surgery carried the risk of paralysis, and she rejected the idea of getting a morphine pump. They told me to expect a 50% reduction in my pain with a stimulator, Miller said. I think I got 80%. Thanks to technological advances and concern about dependence on narcotics, implantation of a device like those that power pacemakers is an option being offered to more people. Dr. John Furry, director of the Pain Medicine Center at HSHS St. Mary's Hospital, and Dr. Atik Wariman, director of Decatur Memorial Hospital, Millennium Pain Center, said they are implanting stimulators at least twice as often as they once did. Furry, who performed Miller's surgery in 2007 and replaced the pulse generator's rechargeable batteries for the first time 8 years and 7 months later on November 3rd, said conclusions by the National Neuromodulation's Appropriateness Consensus Committee in 2014 are what opened the door to more patients. Neurostimulation used to be relegated to someone who had tried everything else, medication, physical therapy, sometimes even surgery, Furry said. Now this therapy belongs before you go to long-acting and strong opioid medications and has a better success rate as a result. Raymond said people suffering from diabetic nerve pain and peripheral vascular disease are now candidates for the treatment, in addition to people suffering from complex regional pain syndrome and those for whom back surgery has failed to give them sufficient pain relief. The treatment can be used for limb, back, neck, and other torso pain. The best successes with the stimulator are with neuropathic or nerve pain, Raymond said. It may be associated with numbness, tingling, and sometimes burning. It does not address pain caused by arthritis, headaches, a broken bone, or other fresh injury, for example. Patients are carefully selected and undergo a week-long trial with pulse generator worn outside the body and connected to electrodes surgically placed in the spinal column. Sedation is used so the patient can be awakened during the procedure to report what the stimulation feels like and where he or she is feeling it. Furry and Riemann use a needle to insert the trial electrodes, then remove everything once the trial is over. After the patient heals for a couple of weeks, the surgeon then makes two incisions during the second procedure to place the permanent electrodes, wires, and stimulator inside the body. The patient must again be wakened during surgery and usually goes home the same day. Both surgeons currently implant Medtronic equipment that allows the patient to safely undergo an MRI later. Other stimulators contain metal, also requiring them to avoid passing through metal detectors. Raymond said he prefers the aforementioned three-step method, insertion, removal, and implantation, over a two-step method that involves inserting permanent electrodes through an incision for the trial. He said the risk of infection is higher from the wires coming outside of the body. Neurostimulation uses electrical impulses to control pain, but no one completely understands why it works. Furry said one theory holds that the pulses activate sensory cells in the spinal cord that suppress pain. Raymond said Millennium Pain Centers are using tiny leads made by Boston Scientific and implanted in rats to better understand the process. Raymond said another manufacturer called Nevro Corporation has even developed a stimulator that uses a frequency too high for the patient to feel that is still effective at reducing their pain. In any case, the surgeons say a vast majority of patients undergoing a trial find significant pain relief from neurostimulation and choose to have a pulse generator implanted. Miller, 75, said her back still forces her to put limits on lifting and on standing and sitting for long periods, but she spends less time resting with the heat pad and more time doing the activities she enjoys. These include walking 2 miles a day and volunteering at the Decatur Memorial Hospital surgery waiting room in St. Mary's Foundation Department in St. John's Lutheran Church. Miller said she likes being able to control the stimulation with a remote, and because she must reduce the power to lie down, and she's comfortable in that position anyway, she turns off the device while sleeping. She recharges the batteries every 2 to 3 weeks with a special belt she wears around her waist. "I feel better when I'm out and doing things," Miller said. "To be able to do things without being in pain, that's a miracle to me." This headline, bill would provide university funds, by Jared Jarman. State Representative Reggie Phillips discussed a bill in an Eastern Illinois University media briefing Tuesday that would provide emergency funding to higher education institutions. House Bill 6409, sponsored by Phillips, Republican of Charleston, and State Representative Ken Duncan, Democrat of Chicago, would appropriate $160 million from state general funds to the Board of Higher Education for emergency assistance to public universities, according to the measure. Phillips said the details as to what constitutes emergency assistance are not clear at this time. It also is not clear which universities would receive the funds. "I can't tell you exactly who it is for," Phillips said. "It is $160 million in emergency funds to colleges facing shortages now. You are looking at those that are getting ready to close their doors." In his eyes, Phillips expects universities such as Eastern and Chicago State University will need funding now because of the dire straits in which they find themselves. Phillips said he hopes Eastern would get a good chunk of that money. The bills that were introduced today are not long-term solutions, but if we can't find a long-term solution right now, then let's find a short-term solution while we work on the long-term solution, Ryder said. Phillips and Ryder said it is now up to Illinois Speaker Michael Madigan and Senate President John Cullerton, both Chicago Democrats, to allow the bills to be put to a vote. That's all we have time for today. This is Kathy with your Decatur News, and from the Herald Tribune and the Herald and Review, you have a good day and stay tuned for the second half.